Hello, welcome to Sunday Profile with me, Richard Addy. This week, the down-to-earth Australian rapidly becoming one of the world's most influential economists. Justin Wolfers is from Sydney, but he lives in Washington. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, a think tank, and well-connected in the US capital. His partner, Betsy Stevenson, is one of President Obama's economics advisers, and he's now lived in America for 20-odd years. But much of Justin Wolfers' influence comes from writing columns for the New York Times, and he writes, publishes, even tweets about a great deal. From jobs growth and other indicators of the health of the US economy to personal happiness. From marriage and divorce to predictive markets, an interest which, as you'll hear, began when he was still at school. Indeed, it's this ability to read the data about complex issues and come up with insights that you and I can understand that mark him out.
One of the great things about Australia academics is this idea that we should do more than just write technical articles. We should also be public intellectuals and be involved in the public sphere. And that sometimes does mean trying to boil the complicated stuff down into more digestible bites.
And you take this across the range. So you write and co-author academic articles, but you also tweet a lot.
No, that's right. One of the reasons for doing that actually is about that form of communication. So, you know, there's a lot of people who follow me, but importantly, there's actually several thousand journalists. So if I have something interesting to say about this morning's economics news, rather than call or be called by half a dozen journalists, I'll just tweet about it. That's out there, and you'll find yourself the next day quoted anywhere from the New York Times to the Sydney Morning Herald.
That's an indicator of what's happened to journalism and the media, of course, because in the old days they would have rung you anyway. But now no one has the time.
Well, it's less of a tax on my time too.
Well, economics is one of those things. It affects our lives on every level, pretty much. But for most of us, it's hard to understand that big picture. You seem to enjoy being a kind of interpreter of that and bringing insights to everyday life, so things that we all can connect with.
Yeah, economics is everywhere. It took me a PhD to discover how simple economics is. And what I really want to do is try and explain just precisely how simple it is. Everywhere you look, you see economic forces. You go to a bar, and you know, if you're in a bar late at night and there's a whole lot of very attractive women and not very many men around, you'll suddenly see the gender balances shift. You'll see a whole bunch of blokes at the door. That's an equilibrium force. That's basic economics. That's supply and demand responding. The only thing that's different there is the good that's being traded or the price that we're talking about. But everywhere you look, you'll see those forces, people responding to incentives.
You've also done some work which has shattered a few myths. This is something that you seem to take some pleasure in. So there's this idea, and this has been quoted a lot, but I want you to talk about it, this idea that money doesn't matter, that money doesn't bring happiness. You say, actually, hang on a minute.
It's one of those things that's very comforting to believe, and I used to believe it until I crunched the numbers. And this really is just an empirical exercise. So the question is, you know, what's the relationship between income and happiness? There's actually three relationships. You could look at within Australia right now, are richer people happier than poor people? And the answer is yes. Second question is, are rich countries like Australia on average happier than poor countries? And people used to believe that wasn't true. And then the third question was, as countries like Australia get richer, do they get happier? And people used to say that's not true either. This is an idea called the Eastland paradox. It's a paradox because some ways of looking at it, income and happiness are related, and other ways it's not. And his preferred view is what matters is being richer than the Joneses. And that way, if you're richer than the Joneses, the rich Australians will be happier than the poor Australians. But as both you and Jones get richer, which is what economic growth does, neither of you get happier. It turns out the Eastland paradox was just wrong, not as a question of theory, but just from looking at the data. Rich people are happier than poor people, and in roughly equal measure, rich countries like Australia are happier than poor countries. And as countries get richer, they're getting happier. It's not to say that it's necessarily money that's making the difference. I'm not going to tell you to quit your job and go and become an investment banker and work 120 hours a week and never see your kids, but rather that money is probably a marker for the sorts of choices that you have. And you know, in a rich country like Australia, many of us have lots of choices and not surprisingly use those choices to live fairly happy lives.
So does that mean that what money gets you is what? Autonomy and agency, and those things make you happy?
I think that's probably right. What I can say is money is very highly correlated with happiness. Correlation's not causation, and the question is, what is it that's driving that? You know, at some levels of economic development, I think we know a lot. You know, if you're going to grow up in Burundi, you grow up dirt poor, you know the feeling of hunger, you may lose a child during childbirth, you're diseased, your life expectancy is short. I think it's no puzzle whatsoever to understand why those folks are less happy. And, you know, I think to suggest otherwise, in fact, would be quite insulting. Mm. And that's exactly what the data say.
All right, well, let's go from Burundi to something that anyone who's married can relate to, because you've been looking at, with your partner actually, Betsy Stevenson, divorce, and found that that ain't what it used to be as well.
Yeah, so the story in the US that one often hears is one out of two marriages ends in divorce, and that a lot of hand-wringing, political hand-wringing about the fact that divorce just keeps rising. It turns out neither fact is true. Fewer than one in two marriages end in divorce, probably quite a lot fewer. It hasn't been true for years. And as much as you'll hear American pundits talk about rising divorce rates and the decline of the American family, in fact, the divorce rate peaked in the United States in 1979. It's been falling every year since. There's been very little change in our public dialogue about how we talk about changing families, even as the facts have changed dramatically.
Do we know why that is?
So I can tell you a story. It's a story based on research, and it actually is a story that works very well for my own family. I'm going to tell you a story about three generations, my grandmother's, my mother's, and mine. My grandmother grew up and got married in the period that you think of as the period of traditional marriage. And traditional marriage, as economists thought about it, was all about the fact that two people together can produce more than they could apart. So the way you do that is mum specializes in the home and dad goes out to work. And the more you specialize, the better you get at each of those jobs. So that's exactly the life my grandma led. She stayed at home. Grandpa went to work. If you want to find the right spouse in that sort of world, what you want is an opposite. It's, my grandmother used to say opposites attract. And it's because the CEO doesn't want to be married to a fellow CEO. He wants to be married to a really good homemaker. You have very different roles. You're in very different spheres. That was the world my grandmother lived in. Let's fast forward to the world I grew up in. Opportunities for women changed enormously. It became illegal to discriminate against them. Women got greater control of their fertility through the pill and access to abortion. And that makes investing in mum's education and mum's career a much better bet. We also had sort of an industrial revolution in the sense that in the old days, it made a lot of sense to have a household specialist because working at home was a very complicated, difficult issue. You had to, for instance, doing washing was actually quite difficult back then. You'd be responsible for cooking for the family and you'd be the family seamstress. Today, my family has our cook is we go to the local supermarket and just buy pre-prepared frozen food. We do have a seamstress. It's not a stay-at-home wife. Instead, it's factory workers in China. We import our clothes. I don't even do my own vacuuming. We have a robot that does the vacuuming for us, much as we have a robot that washes our dishes and cleans our clothes. And all of that means that it no longer makes sense for us as a family to have a stay-at-home specialist because housework became so simple that even a man could do it. And so I chose the right partner for that world. The right partner for that world is someone who's quite similar to you. You have shared interests and shared passions. So my mum's generation is the one where they grew up thinking that they would be like my grandma's generation. They went into an opposites attract marriage. The world changed. They got a lot more opportunities, and they found themselves with exactly the wrong bloke for the world we live in. So as a result, they separated. We saw divorce rise in the US, much as it did in Australia, strongly through the 1970s and 1980s as couples of that generation separated. So that explains why we saw the big rise in divorce. And then what's happened is subsequent generations have found the right partners for the world that we live in. And that's why my partner and I are still together. And I think this gives you a nice story because it tells you about why divorce rose and also why it's fallen.
I wonder if there's anything in the fact that we're marrying later as well. You know, you know a bit more about yourself when you're, say, I don't know, 30 than you did when you were 22.
Absolutely. I think that's a big part of it. It comes out of the same story, which is today you're trying to marry your soulmate. And so you need to know who you are before you can figure out who your soulmate is, so you'll marry later. People are very much delaying marriage, and that's leading to a lot more stable matches.
Now, I've already mentioned your partner, Betsy Stevens, and she's an economist as well. She's an economic advisor to President Obama. You're a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute, which is a think tank. I have to ask, how is the state of the US economy going?
Well, if you ask Betsy, she has to tell you that it's really great. You know, the recession was dreadful, and every time you get upset about the state of the economy today, go back and look at how bad it was 5 years ago in the United States. The recovery, though, I think is moving along. We've got unemployment in the United States down to 5.8%, which is not as low as we'd want it to be, but it's on the right path. So I feel quite good about the US economic prospects today, although I worry a lot about the rest of the world. Japan looks sick and Europe looks perhaps even sicker.
I've read profiles of you in which it sort of implies that you and Betsy are these two incredibly clever economists, which I wouldn't doubt for a moment, and that economics pervades all your decisions at home. How true is that?
I think it's true for me, but I also think it's true for you. Anytime you're making a decision, you're thinking about costs and benefits. Now, we think about economics in a very broad sense, which is costs and benefits are not just dollar bills. Costs and benefits include, you know, do you love what you're doing? And it includes thinking about other people, and it includes being generous, and it includes having emotions. But yeah, we're social scientists, and I see economics at work everywhere I look, and to be honest, I don't know how else to think.
So have you ever found yourself, Justin, making a decision which doesn't make economic sense? It's just something you've done.
I'll tell you the closest I think I've come to that is when we decided to whether or not to have kids. I analyse a lot of data on happiness, and it turns out if you look at how happy people are, parents are less happy than non-parents. People are less happy when they're with their kids during the day than when they're not. Childcare is not something that makes people happy. People are more happy either before their kids are born or just after their kids go off to uni than at any other time in their lives. So all of this says that having kids is a dreadful idea. We went ahead and we had kids. Little Matilda was the first, and Oliver a few years later, and it's the best decision we ever made. If you defined economics as being about dollars and cents, which would be the wrong thing to do, then this is a terrible decision. If you define economics as being about making purposeful decisions, we certainly made very purposeful decisions. We thought a lot about costs and benefits. We understood one of the costs would be we might be less happy, but there's a deeper sense of meaning that I get out of being a dad, and to be honest, I think I'm a better bloke as a result. And a bad economist would ignore that, but a good economist would understand that these are important things to take into account in your cost-benefit calculus.
Having children is intrinsically rewarding. On Sunday yes. Profile, I'm Richard Adie, and the expatriate Australian economist Justin Wolfers is my guest. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and visiting professor of economics at the University of Sydney, among other things. Justin's writing and papers on everyday economics have grabbed the attention of people whose eyes would normally glaze over at the mere mention of GDP. So, Justin, I have to ask, how did this start? How did you get interested in economics?
I was very lucky. I went to high school at James Roos in Sydney, and I had two of the most amazing high school economics teachers you can imagine, Mr. Dunkley and Mr. Lees. You know, as a young bloke, my parents had just gotten divorced, and I was having a hard time of things. And I decided I wanted to take my studies a bit more seriously. And those two guys were incredibly generous with their time. And they introduced me to a subject that I've loved. And I couldn't be more grateful.
Does this come out of being good at maths?
I was always pretty good at maths. And to get through an American PhD program, or even probably to be a professor of economics, you've got to be not terrible at it. And I probably succeed at being not terrible. But economics is a social science. We're about making people's lives better. It's more than about, you know, columns of figures. And I do think that there are important skills above and beyond being able to add and subtract.
One of the things I've heard about you is that early ability in maths and interest in the world led you to, of all places, the track.
Yes. So you know how in year 10 at high school you have to do work experience? I went off and I did work experience with Ian Craig, who was a race caller in Sydney at the time. And then the next week with a bookie. And I just loved it. You know, it is all about numbers and it's also all about markets. If you've ever spent any time in a betting ring, it's one of the most pure financial markets you can ever be a part of. And so I worked my way through high school and then through uni working for various bookies, Warren Woodcock in particular. And it taught me a lot of really important economics lessons, because you get to be part of a market the same way a financial market trader does, and get to see how they work.
So it wasn't the horses, it wasn't the track, it wasn't anything around that, it was the numbers and the markets.
I'll admit that that's right. There's a lot of glamorous things about the track, and I was interested in none of them. There's a lot of nerdy things, and that really grabbed my attention.
So why didn't you end up becoming Tom Waterhouse and making a fortune?
So I think the answer is because I'm not very good at it. I finished high school. I wasn't going to go to uni. And Jeff Landry, who was a rails bookmaker in Sydney at the time, hired me, and I was going to work for him for a few years and go on and become a bookie and hopefully be bigger than the Waterhouses. My first week on the job with Jeff, I screwed a bunch of things up. The details aren't that important, but it was all my fault, and Jeff fired me. I couldn't find a job for the next couple of weeks, so I thought, oh, what the heck, I'll go to uni. And so I went to uni and studied economics, and that's what I've done ever since. I have actually had a chance as an economics professor to go back and do some research on the economics of horse racing. So that initial passion wasn't totally lost. And in fact, one of the things I study is things like prediction markets and how bookies' odds can do a better job of predicting elections and things like that.
Mm.
So it wasn't entirely lost.
I would imagine, given your experience and take upon the world, that you are not a punter, that you essentially know better.
That's a good question. I should know better, shouldn't I? Now, you know, one of the great things about being in the US is it's a largely Puritan culture, and there's not as much gambling over here, so I'm not tempted quite as often as I was, but I've enjoyed a wager or two in my time.
So you went off to the University of Sydney and did economics. I think you got the university medal, actually, and then later you joined the Reserve Bank. But were you always interested in the social science part? You've already talked about the kind of how it affects our lives rather than, say, the modelling?
Absolutely. You know, what hit me both in high school and then in uni, you know, you're in your late teens, early 20s. The thing that hit you then, did for me for sure, is sort of an emerging social conscience, a sense that we should be trying to do something better and trying to better the world, and that's what economics is all about. I remember as I was studying for my HSC in Sydney, one of the things they have you do is remember the latest economic statistics. Well, this was 1990 and Australia was entering a recession. And the unemployment rate that I had to memorize each month just kept going up and up. And I understood very much then, it was still a visceral memory, that that was not just an extra percentage point. That was hundreds of thousands of people's lives and their well-being. And getting that right and helping to avoid future recessions seemed to me to be just about as noble a calling as you can imagine.
So how did you end up going to the US? Was it always part of the plan?
No, you know, I went to the Reserve Bank of Australia. It was a splendid initial education, both in economics and understanding how policy works. And they have a policy of sort of sending their bright young things off to the US to study for a few years with the understanding that you meant to come back home and work in policy. So they sent me off to Harvard. I didn't follow through on my side of the deal, I'm afraid. I stayed in the US. I think Glenn Stevens is probably still mad at me. But the thing I learned in the US is, you get to do economics very much more on the world stage, which is the research I do over here is not just about trying to influence the Reserve Bank of Australia, but a lot of what I do will end up being seen by central banks in Australia and Canada and India and China and all around the world. And so, you know, there is a possibility, if I do good economics, and of actually influencing policy all around the world, and that's been kind of powerful for me.
So that's essentially, it's in your line of work, this is the big leagues.
Yeah, this is the Broadway stage for academic economists.
Yeah. All right. So now you're in Washington D.C. and of course for years now it's been famously problematic, indeed sometimes often gridlocked, and that's before actually the Republicans officially take over the House. Do political machinations frustrate you, particularly if they get in the way of good policy?
Immensely. There's an enormous, particularly in the US, but you've seen a little bit of this in Australia, an enormous and growing disjunction between what we as economists know and some of the nonsense that politicians are willing to spout. So you see, you know, global warming's the obvious issue. You see this most clearly, you see it very clearly in Australia, but there's the economic equivalent of global warming. There's the insistence on fiscal austerity somehow as a magical cure for recessions, for instance. And the result is that the political debate becomes somewhat separated from what we actually know. And one of our failings as economists is we haven't educated the public well enough for them to call it nonsense when it is nonsense. And I hope that, you know, we can do better at trying to discipline the bad guys.
Mm. Good luck with that. The politicians, yes. this is their main skill set. So what are you working on now, Justin?
Today I was working on trying to understand income inequality across different countries around the world. I'm doing a lot more work on happiness, work on forecasting elections, which is something I've enjoyed doing for quite a while. And also I follow the macroeconomy and hopefully have occasionally a few useful things to say.
Now, I know you're a long way away, but you are an Aussie. What do you make of the Australian economy? There's a bit of a panic on here about the end of the mining boom and drop in commodity prices and economic weakness.
Yeah, so one of the great things that being a long way away does is affords me perspective. And the perspective is the Australian economy has had an extraordinary performance over the past 30 years. And so when people ask me for economic advice over here, I say the most important things to do are to have a big, modern, dynamic economy right next to China that happens to be located along on top of a whole lot of really valuable minerals. And Australia has done that very well. You know, there was a time when we thought that unemployment in Australia could never get below 7.5%. That's back when I worked at the Reserve Bank. And now we hope that we'll never return to that. So through the long run of history, I think Australia is doing very well. In an international comparison, Australia is doing very well. And yes, we face challenges right now. The end of the mining boom, declines in commodity prices, potential slowdown from China mean that we'll face some challenges. And I hope that policymakers are up to the task and can keep the economy moving forward. But, you know, overall, I think Australians should be thrilled by the performance of their economy. I know no one will be. You know, I will say one of the most puzzling things is that no country weathered the global financial crisis better than Australia. Yet when you read the Australian media, I saw Wayne Swan continually getting beaten up on for not doing better. He'd done better than any other country in the world. So I do wish the Australian economics media was sometimes a little better at emphasising the enormous positives we have.
What about Australia more personally, Justin? Ever think about coming home?
Australia is home, mate. So, yes. My two children, one's named Matilda. You can see there's a nod to home there. And my other son, Oliver, his middle name is Zachary, which gives him the initials Oz. So that might give you a sense that I still very much identify with the place. I will say, though, that I've taken a dual citizenship now, half American. Once your children are American, it does change a little bit of who you are. But that said, I've recently signed on as a visiting professor at the University of Sydney, which is my alma mater. And I hope that keeps me connected with the Australian economics and policy communities.
What do you still want to do while you're in America?
I've worked very hard as a younger economist to try and get in a position where I could have some influence. And I'm only just starting to step into the very beginning of that now. I now want to use that influence for good. So I write a column for the New York Times, which has actually much more influence than a lot of what the other stuff I do. I edit one of the major economics journals over here, and I'm trying to use that as a vehicle for reshaping how economists, and particularly macroeconomists, think about the world. It's been really exciting watching my better half go into the administration, the Obama administration, and work directly on policy issues, and I definitely want to continue to be involved in the policy debate. You know, I have a voice now, and I guess it's time to use it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
A pleasure, Richard.
Justin Wolfers is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute in Washington and visiting professor of economics at the University of Sydney. If you want to find out more or listen again or make a comment on the interview, head to the website abc.net.au/radionational. The program is produced by Belinda Sommer. I'm Richard Attie.